Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, December 9th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page, Miracle on Main, 100 Years and Still Printin', an article by Tom Kasich. For much of its life, the Champaign News Gazette, the newspaper formed 100 years ago this week with the merger of the Champaign Daily News and Champaign Daily Gazette, has faced financial stress. It was born, in fact, from financial difficulties, partly the result of World War I that ended a year earlier. But none of the money problems were mentioned in the cheery story that appeared at the bottom of page one on Sunday, December 14th, 1919, when the first Champaign News Gazette was published. We come to you this morning not as a new paper, but as the joining of the two forces which have served you in the past, said the anonymous greeting, likely written by the publisher of the new paper, D.W. Stevick, who for 4 years had run the Daily News. There was no need for Stevick to go into detail about the merger. The other local newspapers, the Urbana Daily Courier and the student-run Daily Illini, had scooped the News Gazette days earlier on its own story. The Courier reported December 8th that Stevick had purchased the Gazette for in the neighborhood of $70,000. 2 days later, the Daily Illini pegged the sum at $60,000, but the narrative was much the same, an indication that Stevick had been the source. Owing to the fact that the cost of operating a newspaper has increased from 3 to 4 times the cost in 1915, and because of the increased cost of paper and higher wages, the News Gazette has followed the action of scores of newspapers throughout the country, merging with its competitor. The necessity of raising subscription prices was an added difficulty. Champaign, moreover, is too small a city to support two papers the size of the News. Keen competition made the operation of both newspapers a losing proposition in many respects. The Courier's publisher, A. Burroughs, offered a similar take in an editorial. In the case of the Courier, the advertising rate today is not 20% higher than it was before the war. In the case of the Gazette, it is not 10% higher than in 1914. The subscription rate of the Courier in that period was only increased from 10 cents a week to 12 cents, while the Gazette has changed from 12 cents to 15 cents. Expenses, however, have doubled, and in the case of print paper, have quadrupled. 5 years ago, printers and pressmen were glad to get $20 a week. Today, they draw from $30 to $35 a week, and at that, they are still underpaid in proportion to the increased cost of living. Newsprint costs more than quadrupled over 5 years, he said, and the Gazette was looking at revenue of about $80,000 in 1920 and expenses of $105,000. The Gazette threw up the sponge, and who wouldn't under those conditions? For more than a decade, the merged newspaper survived but hardly thrived. Then another crisis, the sudden sale of the News Gazette in July 1933 to a small group of News Gazette employees. Stevick was to get $200,000 in notes from the sale, plus $15,000 a year for the rest of his life. But he sued, claiming the newspaper had been sold while he was mentally distracted and that it was worth $600,000 and not $200,000. The trial in Champaign County Circuit Court got spectacular front-page treatment in the Courier, as well as regular coverage in the Daily Illini, but there was no mention of it in the News Gazette, whose publisher now was Robert P. McKinley, a public accountant. Lily Procise was listed as secretary treasurer. It was she who negotiated the sale of the newspaper and informed Stevick. You should sign those papers. If you don't, you can't get a cent. The paper has been sold, Stivick's chauffeur testified. Stivick's attorney, O.B. Dobbins, said that the new owners knew his mental and physical condition, took advantage of his condition, and robbed him. Elmer Blow, business manager of the News Gazette, testified that Stevick had allowed the newspaper's equipment to deteriorate. And local contractor A.W. Stuhlman said the News Gazette building at 48 Main Street is in poor condition, and that any severe shock would be likely to cause the building to collapse. Later, the top 2 floors of the building were removed. Almost a year to the day that the News Gazette was sold, Stevick regained control with an out-of-court settlement. It was immediately reported in the Courier, although News Gazette readers weren't informed until a week later, with a terse announcement that Mr. McKinley has for a consideration agreed between the parties, sold all his interest to Mr. Stevic in the capital stock of the corporation. A series of stock notes originally made out to Stevic in 1927 and transferred to McKinley in 1933 simply read, "Canceled July 14, 1934. Stevic died the following year at the age of 48, and for the next two-thirds of a century, his wife Helen and daughter Marijan owned and operated the paper with the help of a host of honest, hard-working, and dedicated employees, mostly. The next round of financial troubles came three decades later when the renamed Champaign-Urbana Courier, which had perennially trailed the News Gazette in advertising and circulation, suddenly became supreme. In 1962, the Courier's circulation was 32,324 to 31,739 for the News Gazette. Aid to the News Gazette came from an unlikely source. The Johnson administration's Justice Department, which in March 1967 charged Lindsay Schaub, Inc. of Decatur with conspiracy in an attempt to monopolize the Urbana-Champaign newspaper market. The government alleged that in an effort to remove the News Gazette from the market, the newspaper chain intentionally operated the Champaign-Urbana Courier at losses of as much as $500,000 a year and subsidized the Courier with profits from its other Illinois newspapers. The government said that over 8 years, Lindsay Schaub had subsidized $3 million in losses at the Courier in order to damage the News Gazette. 2 months later, a consent decree barred the chain from offering special low rates to advertisers who agreed to not advertise in a competing paper. It also prevented Lindsay Schaub from purchasing the News Gazette. 12 years later, Lindsay Schaub and the Courier went out of business, and the News Gazette's most profitable days followed. A strong local economy, a contract to print a downstate edition of the Chicago Tribune, and a virtual newspaper monopoly in East Central Illinois propelled the newspaper through the 1980s and 90s. It expanded into the Danville market, became a 24-hour operation with three editions daily, and moved from the 48 Main Street building, once a harness factory and the newspaper's home for 70 years, down the street to a spacious, remodeled three-story building. The 2000s, however, pummeled the News Gazette with a succession of setbacks. The rapid embrace of the Internet and its instant access to news and information, the loss of the Tribune printing contract, a major recession, difficulties for the entire newspaper industry, and a sad and costly betrayal of D.W. Stevic's only child, Marijan, by her trusted attorney and newspaper CEO. In that episode, John Hirschfeld, Marijan Stevic's Chiquino's attorney for 38 years, eventually lost his law license after he was accused by a state licensee board of misconduct for overbilling the newspaper's umbrella corporation by more than $1 million over 5 years, committing a fraudulent real estate transaction, fraudulently using a signature stamp, and improperly revealing the confidences of a client. Mrs. Chiquino died two years after the negotiated agreement was reached, and Hirschfeld, a one-time state representative and Republican Party heavyweight, never returned to prominence in his hometown. He died in 2014. All of that hastened the News Gazette's demise, leading to a declaration of bankruptcy in August. The corporation estimated its assets at $1 million to $10 million and its liabilities, in particular pension obligations, at between $10 and $50 million. The new owners of the nearly 100-year-old merged Champaign Daily News and Champaign Daily Gazette, the Champaign Multimedia Group, took over in November. There was a time 30 years ago or so when someone in the newsroom printed up T-shirts with the slogan, "The News Gazette, the Miracle on Main Street." It was a reference to all journalists, printers, bundle haulers, and everyone else who had suddenly upped their game and proudly put out an award-winning newspaper with three editions a day and a circulation of more than 50,000. But that informal slogan could just as easily have referred to a small-town newspaper that somehow survived mismanagement, looting, depressions and recessions, aggressive competition, technological shifts, changes in the public's appetite for news, and other financial stresses. That's the real miracle going on for 100 years. Also on the front page, Trip East allows for special delivery. Bobby Mitchell, who missed September's Hall of Fame ceremony, now has his trophy from College Park, Maryland. The University of Illinois officially inducted 16 new members into its Athletic Hall of Fame in late September. Former Illini greats, including Simeon Rice, Deion Thomas, and Ashley Bergen, made it back to campus for the ceremony. In total, 11 of the 12 living members of the 2019 class were in Champaign for Hall of Fame weekend. A health issue kept former Illinois football great Bobby Mitchell at his Washington, D.C. home. Mitchell, however, was able to get his Hall of Fame trophy Saturday with Illinois men's basketball on the road at Maryland. It was a short trip for Associate Athletic Director Kent Brown and Varsity I Director Lee Zarin to hand deliver the trophy to one of the greatest athletes in school history. When we found out he wasn't going to be able to make it to Champaign, we kind of circled this to come out and give it to him, Zarinson said Saturday from the Xfinity Center in College Park, Maryland, ahead of the Illini's 59-58 loss to number 3 Maryland. Hopefully he can come back and get to it in front of the fans, but we wanted to make sure he got his trophy and have a chance to visit with him. Mitchell was a two-sport athlete at Illinois, competing in football and track. He was an all-Big Ten running back in 1955 and set a world record in 1957 in the 70-yard low hurdles in helping the Illini win the 1958 Big Ten Indoor Championship. Mitchell was picked in the seventh round of the 1958 NFL draft by the Cleveland Browns, where he teamed with Jim Brown. He was traded to the Washington Redskins prior to the 1962 season and was the first African American to play for that franchise. He was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1983 after compiling 14,000 total yards in 11 seasons. We were sitting in the basement with all his Pro Football Hall of Fame stuff, and he kept talking about how much he loved his Illini and how great it was to see them being successful and moving forward. He had his Hall of Fame bust and pro memorabilia, but there was just as much Illinois stuff down there, too. His varsity letter is hanging on the wall. It was pretty cool. Plenty of photos adorn the basement walls, too. One of the more notable was from an event Brown held in support of Muhammad Ali when the legendary boxer made the headlines for refusing to be drafted for the Vietnam War. Mitchell was in it alongside Brown, Ali, and 13-time NBA champ Bill Russell, among others. Another photo of the same three hung nearby from Ali's birthday not long before his death in 2016. It was a highlight for me in my short career, the 31-year-old Zerusin said. You get speechless sometimes talking with him and hearing his experiences. I grew up as a fan, so it's really cool that part of my job is to reach out to Bobby Mitchell and Simeon Rice and really get a chance to know some of the guys I watched growing up. And from the local page, research home at U of I is still a hot topic. As the days have gotten colder, many of us have likely turned up the heat in our homes. This easy task is one way we take for granted, and we may not think about how it was developed. One part of the story takes place in Urbana. The Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of Illinois, in collaboration with the National Warm Air Heating and Ventilation Association, created the Warm Air Heating Residence, or Research Residence No. 1. The goal of this house was to find the most efficient home heating methods. It was commissioned, designed, and built in 1924 and located at 1108 West Stoughton Street in Urbana. While there had been heating in homes before this time, there were no set standards for houses. The NWAHVA and university stepped in to help rectify this. The team at the research residence was led by Arthur Cutts Willard, Vincent S. Day, and A.P. Kratz. Some of them had previously been studying heating and ventilation at the laboratory test plant designed to conduct heating experiments and located in the mechanical engineering laboratory. One goal of the research residents was to see how accurate the laboratory testing was when applied to a real house. The team would install a system, test it, and then make modifications or sometimes have a completely new design. Between 1924 and 1927, there were five different installations to find the most efficient way for heating a home. These systems were gravity warm air heating systems. A stove would be located in the basement with a duct bringing in outside air. The heated air would then be left to naturally flow through the leader pipes to different rooms in the house. The air would be heated to between 175 to 185 Fahrenheit in the furnace, so that the rest of the house would be around 70 degrees. Some of the tests included comparing insulated and uninsulated leader pipes, what size pipes work best, and what type of materials work best for the furnace, such as copper or steel. In January of 1927, the research resident's fifth installation was able to be tested in below zero temperature. For 2 days, the temperature outside fluctuated between 16 below and 10 degrees. Inside the research residence, the temperature was taken in every room throughout the course of those days. The temperatures were recorded at floor, breathing line, and ceiling height, with thermometers hanging from those heights off of a pole. The results showed that this system could keep the temperature uniform and at a comfortable level, with an average about 70 degrees, with only a 1 to 2 degree fluctuation. The experiments at the research residence were successful, with many people coming to visit to see the different systems. It was also featured in Better Homes Week. The Better Homes movement was a post-World War I nationwide campaign emphasizing home ownership, modernization, and beautification, and this experiment helped showcase the best ventilation systems. This success also led to three more research residences to be built. The house is still standing and was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2001. The Illinois Distributed Museum has online content about the innovations that have come from the University of Illinois, as well as self-guided tours of campus where you can view objects and buildings related to these innovations. The Illinois Distributed Museum is a project under the direction of the University of Illinois Archives. See more online. The Illinois Distributed Museum is also a member of the Champaign County Museums Network. Learn more online. An article by Krista Vance. Something smells fishy here. Let me help, hon, my dad said as he lifted his feet off the coffee table. Thanks, Dad, I said as I rolled my preteen eyes. I sprayed Pledge on a rag and put my arm to work, bringing a shine to the coffee table and a delightful poisonous odor to the room. Hon, let me give you some advice, my dad said. Start at one end and make tiny circles, then repeat the process, enlarging the circles each time until the circle's circumference is table width. Have I mentioned my dad was an engineer? I made circles underneath my dad's feet with his eagle eyes overseeing me. My biggest childhood challenge was Saturday morning cleaning. How long could I sleep in and still finish my chores before my mom got home from work? As a rural postal carrier, her job didn't have a set end time. When the mail was delivered, her day was done. It took years for me to realize Christmas time with store ads and cards meant a lot more sleep than summertime. Every 4 weeks, the house had to be especially clean because my dad hosted card playing club. This is going to sound weird, but they actually played cards. I'm in a woman's book club, and we've never even read a book. We do drink lots of wine. For card playing club, my dad was in charge of choosing the snacks. There were four options: tuna fish sandwiches, canned chili, fried spam, or sardines with crackers. He always chose the same thing. I'm thinking sardines for snack, my dad suggested. No, my mom said in her no-nonsense voice. You'll have tuna fish sandwiches. I don't like the disgusting smell in my house after you eat fish drowning in its own juices. Fine, he said, but I need a can of cat food. My mom and I looked at him. I'm afraid to ask, she said. I had an idea. I'm replacing the tuna fish label with a cat food one, and I'm telling the fellas you're putting me on a special diet. It won't work, she said. Sure it will. You're always trying crazy ideas to get me to lose weight. I expect much vomiting to ensue. Dad, that's totally awesome. It is, if I do say so myself, he said proudly. Krista, it's a secret. You can't tell anyone. Okay. Please, I can't keep a secret. I told all my friends, many of whose dads were in the card-playing club. And guess what? My friends can't keep secrets either. By Saturday, all the club members were in on the prank. Well, they were in on my dad's prank, but he wasn't the only devious mind in the family. Since Saturday's game was such a special occasion, I delivered the food on a silver platter, the lid of our metal garbage can that I had sprayed off with the hose. Back in the day, nobody worried about germs. I hid any remaining stuck-on gunk underneath the plates. My brilliance started at an early age. My dad sat at the head of the table, and although etiquette dictated I serve him first, I left him for last. I placed his cat food, the can opener, and fork in front of him. Bon appetit, Dad. Thanks, hun, he smiled. I love cat food. Your mom's new diet is working. He patted his belly. All eyes were on him. He opened the lid and frowned. Without pause, one of the club members reached their fork forward toward the cat food, but in my middle school eagerness, I was quicker and shoved a huge bite of what was supposed to be tuna fish in my mouth, except I froze. Have I mentioned my dad has asthma? He laughed so hard he gave himself an asthma attack. My mom shoved a paper towel in front of my face. Spit it out. All I could do was open my mouth and cry. She grabbed the fork, scraped the cat food from my mouth and onto the paper towel, then used the other side to wipe off my tongue, but she didn't get it all. Here, she handed me a glass of water. I took a big gulp, swallowed, and threw up on the table. You wish you were supposed to switch, my mom yelled, holding back my hair. And that's when the domino effect kicked in. Two of the guys added their stomach contents onto the table. By that point, my dad was on his knees, soundlessly laughing and pointing at my mom. It was you, he wheezed. You changed back the labels. I did, she laughed. How does the house smell now, he snorted. To this day, the smell of wet cat food makes me gag, and I don't care if our cats lose all their teeth. They're not getting any fancy feast. They better figure out how to gum their dinner. And from Bement, Iowa, man arrested after shots fired near house. Piatt County Sheriff, he was talking really crazy like he's God and nobody could kill him. An Iowa man who allegedly fired shots outside a home Saturday in Bement, prompting the evacuation of several homes, was taken into custody after about 2 hours without anyone being physically hurt. Piatt County Sheriff David Hunt said Norimar Siway, 23, of Cedar Rapids, was arrested on preliminary charges of aggravated assault with a firearm and unlawful use of weapons. Hunt said Piatt County State's Attorney Dana Rhodes will decide today what formal charges to file. Meanwhile, Siway was in the Piatt County Jail in Monticello being monitored. Hunt said the bizarre incident started about 8:30 a.m., when Siway pulled his car into a driveway of a home on Mansfield Street near Macon Street on the south edge of the village. Siway got out of his car and allegedly began firing a handgun into the air. He was just a stranger, highly intoxicated, Hunt said. The homeowners recognized there was someone outside with a gun. The homeowner grabbed his own gun, a shotgun, and fired a couple of rounds over his head after first warning him he was going to shoot. At that time, the guy pointed the gun toward the house and fired some rounds in the air. He was talking really crazy like he's God and nobody could kill him. He tried to get in the homeowner's car but couldn't find the keys, then got back in his own car and couldn't find his own keys. He was stuck there with all the responding units. Four Illinois state troopers and six Piatt County deputies, including Hunt and his chief deputy, quickly converged on the usually quiet town of about 1,700, which is 7 miles due south of Monticello, the county seat. He said police did an excellent job of securing the area. One of my deputies was able to sneak the residents out of the back of the house and get them to safety, Hunt said of the two adults and two children who were home. Police also evacuated about five other nearby homes and directed the residents downtown to a restaurant. Hunt said although none of his deputies is specifically trained in hostage negotiation, one did a good job trying to communicate with Sioway while a negotiator from state police was being summoned. The deputy was doing a pretty good job of trying to talk him down and keep him calm. He was very agitated. Once he got back in the vehicle, communications were a little harder. He would open the door to say something like he wanted his keys and wanted to leave, said Hunt, who speculated that Sioway believed mistakenly that police had his car keys. After a while, he just got out of his car. He was rapping to a song and started walking toward us, so one of my deputies tackled him, thinking he might still have the gun. The gun, a Glock 9mm, was later found in his car, which was impounded. Hunt said they'll get a search warrant for today to see if there is anything inside that might shed light on his behavior. The strong odor of cannabis coming from him and some of his unusual statements led police to believe he might have been under the influence of something. And from Chicago, Cubs facing review on accessibility. Federal officials are investigating whether the Chicago Cubs' $1 billion renovation of Wrigley Field provides adequate wheelchair access. The Cubs have filed a notice of the review in federal court, where the team is defending itself against a lawsuit filed by a wheelchair user who alleges the stadium seating doesn't meet Americans with Disabilities Act standards and is actually worse than before the renovation. The Chicago Tribune reported that a team attorney wrote that the Cubs believe the renovation was significantly increased accessibility in the 105-year-old stadium, but plans to install more accessible seating before the 2020 season are being halted. And from Tom's mailbag, there are several surveying markers all along University Avenue in Urbana from Wright Street to the far east side of the city. Do we know what they are working on? Right-of-way is being staked for the University Avenue project. The project limits are from Wright Street to Cunningham Avenue in Urbana, said Kensel Garnett, the Region 3 engineer for the Illinois Department of Transportation. Open Road Paving is the contractor, and work should begin in the spring of 2020. Will Candlestick Lane in Urbana open? It will open with a ceremony at 5 p.m. Saturday, December 14th. This will be the 56th or maybe the 59th year for the holiday tradition in the East Urbana neighborhood around Grant Place and Eastern and Fairlawn Drives. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, December 9th. Please stay tuned.